This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with an author of a new biography about Thomas Young, who joined the Army 2 days after the 9/11 attacks.
Instead of going to Afghanistan, they sent him to Iraq, and several days later, he was paralyzed from the chest down. His book, Thomas Young's War, by Mark Wilkerson, is, in my opinion, the finest anti-war book to come out of this Iraq period.
We'll talk with the new executive director of the TOR project, Shari Steele, about TOR, encryption, and privacy.
The TOR project is institutionalizing what Edward Snowden scared us about. More power to him.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
At age 19, Thomas Young joined the Army 2 days after the 9/11 attacks. For patriotic reasons, he wanted to fight in Afghanistan because of that country's connection to the attack. But he was instead deployed to Iraq, a country that had zero connection to the attacks on September 11, 2001. He was in Iraq but a few days when he was shot in an insurgent ambush while sitting in the back of an open truck driving through the area of unrest in Baghdad. The first shot severed his spinal cord, paralyzing him from the nipples on down. The second shot shattered his knee. He never felt it. Thomas Young lived for 9 years with his catastrophic injury. He became a forceful and eloquent spokesman against the war in Iraq. The movie Body of War was made about him. Thomas died of his injuries in 2014 at the age of 34. His single mother, Kathy Smith, advocated for him and cared for him. Mark Wilkerson wrote his biography, Thomas Young's War. They are both here in New York on a book tour, and they join us today in our studio. Kathy Smith, Mark Wilkerson, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's wonderful to be here.
Kathy, you were living in Kansas City as a single mother of four. Thomas Young was your oldest. And when he was 19, he enlisted just 2 days after 9/11. Why did he enlist? And tell us what happened from there, please. How did he get hurt, and what was the result?
Well, we were sitting at home, and he was watching the president stand on the pile of rubble with the megaphone, and we were going to hunt the evildoers out of their caves, and he wanted to go to Afghanistan and help seek some form of retribution for the 9/11 attacks. He got caught up in the false patriotism that was happening at the time. So he enlisted September 13th and shipped out not too long after. He was actually in Kuwait. They go to Kuwait for a while before, and then had actually been in Iraq for 5 days, went out on a mission in Sadr City. They had almost like a Black Hawk Down situation where a Charlie company was in a truck and they were pinned down. So they sent all of these guys out in this LMTV. There were like 20 of them in the back end of it. And it was the day that they had shut down the media in Sadr City, and all of al-Sadr's, I don't think I'm pronouncing that right, al-Sadr.
Yeah, he was one of the leaders of the insurgents in that kind of slum area of Baghdad that the United States couldn't control.
Right, and they had snipers up on the roof, and he was shot twice. Once it was in the collarbone, went through and severed his spinal cord. He was unfortunately wearing an older flak vest that had the ceramic plates, and so it went between the two ceramic plates in the flak vest. And he liked to say he was paralyzed from the nipple down just because he liked to say nipple. So that was in 04, 4-4 of 04, which he always told everyone was the same day that Martin Luther King got shot. So he was, you know, that was his kind of part of his legacy.
Mark, how did it come about that you did this book?
I think a precursor to everything was my own military service. I was in the Army from 88 to 96, and I had a little brush with combat in Somalia in 1993, just shortly before the Black Hawk Down incident. So I think that kind of laid the groundwork. And then when I was working on a book in 2007 about Pete Townshend, the guitarist for The Who, I contacted Eddie Vedder from Pearl Jam about writing the foreword to the book. And at the time that I contacted Eddie, he was working on some songs for Phil Donahue's film about Thomas, Body of War. That's how I became aware of Thomas's story. The movie came out about 6 months later, and I watched the movie with a great deal of interest. Thomas was a very endearing personality, very strong character, very likable, and also just his circumstances were very unique and, of course, horrific. But it was a very inspiring story, too, of course, because he became a very well-known and effective activist. Fast forward 5 years, I hadn't heard anything about Thomas really until early 2013 when he wrote what was called his last letter to George Bush and Dick Cheney, talking about you know, his grievances with the war, and also disclosing that he was on hospice care and that he was planning to end his life. And really at that point, when I heard that, I realized that Body of War was really just act one in this tragedy, and I wanted to know what had happened. And I reached out to Thomas, and pretty quickly we, you know, he agreed that I could tell his story, and within like 10 days I was out at his house to start doing interviews with him. So that's how it started.
Kathy, you helped take care of Thomas, and what happened to him and the daily routine of just keeping him going. I mean, this is really an adult book, a powerful book when you read what is described by Mark. And I wanted to ask you, what were some of the unpleasant realities of Thomas's day-to-day existence? When you have a spinal cord injury, that affects everything. You can still feel pain. Your body can't control your blood pressure, your body temperature. He was on all these medications. Tell me, what did his body look like? What kind of medications were you on? What did you have to do to him and for him to take care of him?
Well, first of all, I think the beginning of the story, we left the Jefferson Barracks VA in St. Louis basically with a bag of pills and no instructions. We had no idea what we were doing. I had no experience with spinal cord injuries. I was not aware that, I just thought you were paralyzed. I did not know that you had to have a bowel program every day to evacuate your bowels, that you had to, he couldn't urinate by himself. He took pills for spasticity. He took pills for his blood pressure, he took Coumadin because of the blood clots, which eventually they took him off of, and that caused the pulmonary embolism that we dealt with later. But he was on antidepressants, and then he had to take nausea medicine because of this pill, and every pill had a side effect that they gave him another pill to counter effect those problems. And we had to learn how to do all of this on our own. The VA didn't teach us how to do any of this at all. But we would get up and do his bowel program, which would take an hour and a half to 2 hours, and then a shower, which was very complicated. He had to roll into the shower, and you know, so just to get out of the house, it would take us 3 or 4 hours just to get ready to go out of the house. And then by then, he was usually nauseous or dizzy and didn't feel like going anywhere. And as far as the pain goes, the entire time after he was injured, they never really dealt with the pain completely. They tried every different kind of medication to deal with it. Eventually, he was on Dilaudid, and he was on a morphine pump for a while. They put him on methadone, everything. And they basically determined with spinal cord injuries that they don't really know how to treat the pain because they're not really sure why they have the pain. It's all under, they shouldn't have the pain, but they do, much like an amputee still feels the phantom leg that's there. It's very much the same. But as far as the way the body deals with it, it can't react to the pain because it's not real. So we spend a lot of time seeking out illegal marijuana, because he found more relief with marijuana than he did with any of the drugs that they gave him from the VA. And it's still not medicinally legal in Kansas City. So we had to go to the the darker side of Kansas City and purchased drugs for Thomas.
Yeah, at one point he actually moved to Portland, Oregon for that very reason. But he got involved with the Iraq Veterans Against the War and was very effective in the anti-war movement. And I wanted to ask both of you about that. He made a visit to Camp Casey. Cindy Sheehan's son, of course, had been killed, and she set up a camp outside of Bush's home in Texas. And Cindy Sheehan went down there, and Thomas, amazingly, was able to get down there. I wanted to ask you about that. And the peace vigils he went to, the anti-war rallies that he spoke at, the churches he spoke at. He was on national television. And then all of this was captured, of course, in that movie Body of War that Phil Donahue did. And I wanted to ask you about his anti-war activities.
It was kind of accidental that we got involved in that. I was looking for a group of mothers whose sons or daughters had been injured. And I came upon MFSO, which is Military Families Speak Out. And through that, we found IVAW, Iraq Veterans Against the War. And I believe that for many years, that saved Thomas's life because he found out that he had a voice and he had a purpose. And it was to him, if we could show this movie and speak to one 18-year-old boy who didn't enlist in the military, that was worth everything we went through to do the movie. And then this book has been a huge thing, the same kind of thing. If one person reads this book and understands what it might involve, and I know that maybe Mark feels differently about military service, and I kind of walk that tightrope because Nathan is very pro-military, and I'm not anti-military at all. We were just against this war, and that was Thomas's war, was against the Iraq War.
The book is called Thomas Young's War by Mark Wilkerson. We're sitting in the studio with both Thomas's mother, Kathy Smith, and Mark. And Mark, I wanted to ask you about the movie Body of War. I know it was premiered in Toronto, and I think, Kathy, you were at the premiere. Talk to us about the movie, both of you.
The Body of War film was, put together by Phil Donahue. Phil had met Thomas at Walter Reed Army Medical Center not long after Thomas had returned from Iraq. The filming took place 2005-2006, quite early on in the time span of Thomas's post-injury life, and it captured him kind of discovering himself as an activist, finding his voice. It captured Camp Casey. It captured him at rallies in Washington, D.C., and, speaking out and showed how effective he was. Unfortunately, it underwent the public release in spring of 2008, just a few months after that premiere in Toronto in September. It was September 11th, actually, of 2007. When it premiered, but it came out to the public March and April of 08, and within a month or 6 weeks of that was when Thomas had his embolism. So the height of his speaking out was essentially over at that point because he lost his ability to speak clearly and, a host of all other issues that really required him to draw back and focus on his health and his well-being.
I wanted to ask you about what kind of care he got at the VA hospitals. He used to say that at the VA, they say that nothing's too good for a veteran, and so nothing's what you'll get. And I know you had a series of unfortunate experiences there, particularly with his contracting the embolism. Can you tell us what your experience was at the VA hospitals and what kind of care was given to Thomas?
This might be a little risky on the radio because I do tend to use bad language when I start talking about the VA.
We can believe you. It's okay.
I have actually been physically removed from the VA 3 times. I have had situations where his potassium level was dramatically low, so they would put him in the emergency room to give him an IV of potassium. And 2 hours later, he still had not been given that IV of potassium. He has the VA, and I really hate to talk badly about the VA because they do really good work. There are a lot of really good doctors, some really good nurses, but they're underfunded, they're understaffed. They're still dealing with a huge population of Vietnam veterans. And so we would wait forever for an appointment. And a lot of times with a spinal cord injury, situations were emergent. And so we would constantly have to go to the emergency room. He would never get to see a primary care physician because the appointments took so long to get. We were dealing with everything on an emergent basis. So you can't deal with situations seeing a different doctor every 2 weeks on an emergency room basis. Thomas was in and out of the hospital. Sometimes we were at the hospital every other week for something different. And there's so many things with a spinal cord injury that are new, like autonomic dysreflexia, that the doctors in the emergency room at the VA would have to literally go over and get on the computer to see what autonomic dysreflexia was. And that is the kind of thing that we dealt with constantly. We would deal with primary care physicians that wouldn't have any physical contact with Thomas, would not even speak to him hardly. They would just sit on the computer and type in everything that we said. And that's how healthcare was at the VA many times.
I just remember when I interviewed you, Kathy, for the book, you talked about when Thomas had come out of his coma after his embolism, and you said it was another time you almost killed a nurse. I remember that quote because Thomas was NPO. He was nothing by mouth, and they gave him applesauce. They gave him pills in applesauce by mouth,
right.
And he aspirated and had to go back into
intensive
care.
He went back into
care.
ICU,
That could kill you. Yeah. I remember reading in the book your observation that they had just stopped giving him Coumadin, the blood thinner, which probably led to the embolism.
Right. Yeah. And they sent him home and told him that he said he had pain in his arm, and they said he had carpal tunnels. Sent him home with painkillers. And then we found him not too long afterwards non-responsive because of the embolism.
And that was really a turning point, wasn't it? Because before the embolism, he was able to transfer from the bed to the wheelchair. He was able to get around. He could use his hands, be more independent. And then afterwards, he really was almost a quadriplegic.
Well, imagine, if you will, you're a 25-year-old man, and all of a sudden you're paralyzed, and you can't use your legs, and you can't do so many other things. And then you learn to deal with that after 4 years, and then you have an embolism. And now you can't use your hands, and you can't use your voice, which you were just beginning to realize was very powerful. And that was his purpose, and he lost that. So that for the last 4 years of his life, it was very different. And we never really recovered. He never really recovered from the embolism, never really got. Just towards the end, he was just starting to feel good about where he was.
And then he passed away. He had talked about when he couldn't stand it anymore, taking his own life, but that didn't come to pass. He died in his sleep. Tell us about that, please.
He had moved to, he was in Seattle then. He had moved to Seattle. And I had seen him a month earlier when he was in Portland. And it had been probably a week. I hadn't talked to him on the phone because we would go a week and talk to each other. And then I think that he just got tired and just gave out. And they said that it was because of all of the medications he was taking. His body just couldn't handle all of the medications anymore. And he had said that he was going to end his own life because he couldn't handle it, and then had decided, because of the outpouring of love from Tom Morello and Eddie, and you know, the concert that they gave, and so many people came to visit him, and just he really felt like he was up for a little bit. You know, he understood that everybody cared about him, not just me and Nathan. And so he had decided he was going to hang on, and then it just happened. So,
yeah, the last time I saw Thomas was in Portland. I'd done a series of short, like 3-day visits to his home in Kansas City every few months in 2013, mostly. And you know, the first time I saw him was just a few weeks after he'd written the last letter, and it was a very dark period. And the last time I saw him was in his apartment in Portland, and he'd had a haircut, he'd quit smoking, he was speaking much more clearly and faster. For example, when I first recorded an interview with Thomas, when I transcribed it at my house later, I didn't even have to hit pause hardly at all. I could just type it out because he was speaking so slowly. And at the last interview I did with him, he was speaking much faster, just like we normally, you know, a normal speaking voice. He was a lot more snarky and sarcastic, and he had put on a little bit of weight, and he was just in a much better place. Mm-hmm. The last time I talked to him was a few weeks before he passed away, and he was really excited about Seattle. He wanted to go see this Jimi Hendrix, Experience Hendrix project thing that was going on. He's in the same town that Eddie Vedder lived in. He was looking forward to seeing Eddie, who was actually on tour at the time. But everything was... Oh, and he was going to write some essays for the book, too. And he was in the process of getting a new laptop so he could do that. But so it was a real shock when I got an email from Nathan the next morning telling me that...
His younger brother... Any last thoughts you want to share with our audience, Kathy?
Actually, this book, as much as the movie and pretty much everything that has happened with Thomas, has been kind of a two-sided coin. I talked about this with my youngest son, Timmy, the other day. It's been, on the one hand, very difficult to sit down and go through all of the stories and the pictures, and so many people are allowed to bury their dead and move on. And we have had to continually get the knock on the door from CNN and go over the same stories and, you know, this experience. At the same time, we have this book. This is my son's legacy. This is part of Thomas Young's legacy that will live on forever and will speak to so many people. And for that, I am so grateful to Mark for giving us this opportunity to share Thomas's story with everyone, because I believe it is a very powerful story, and not just about the war or Iraq, but about an incredible man who touched anybody who ever met my son was touched by him for sure. And he was a great light. And so we are fortunate to be able to share this, and I thank you for that, Mark.
Thank you so much.
Mark, we're very grateful for the hard work you put in writing Thomas Young's War. Mark Wilkerson, Kathy Smith, Thomas Young's mother, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
In 2004, as Thomas Young believed himself to be dying, he wrote an open letter which became a sensation to Bush and Cheney about his feelings about the war. Heidi Boghossian and I are going to read the letter for you.
I write this letter on the 10th anniversary of the Iraq War on behalf of my fellow Iraq War veterans. I write this letter on behalf of the 4,488 soldiers and Marines who died in Iraq. I write this letter on behalf of the hundreds of thousands of veterans who have been wounded, and on behalf of those whose wounds, physical and psychological, have destroyed their lives. I am one of those gravely wounded. I was paralyzed in an insurgent ambush in 2004 in Sadr City. My life is coming to an end. I am living under hospice care.
I write this letter on behalf of husbands and wives who have lost spouses, on behalf of children who have lost a parent, on behalf of the fathers and mothers who have lost sons and daughters, and on behalf of those who care for the many thousands of my fellow veterans who have had brain injuries. I write this letter on behalf of those veterans whose trauma and self-revulsion for what they have witnessed, endured, and done in Iraq have led to suicides, and on behalf of the active duty soldiers and Marines who commit, on average, a suicide a day. I write this letter on behalf of the some 1 million Iraqi dead and on behalf of the countless Iraqi wounded. I write this letter on behalf of all of us, the human detritus your war has left behind, those who will spend the rest of their lives in unending pain and grief.
I write this letter, my last letter, to you, Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney. I write not because I think you will grasp the terrible human and moral consequences of your lies, manipulation, and thirst for wealth and power. I write this letter because, before my own death, I want to make it clear that I, and hundreds of thousands of my fellow veterans, along with millions of my fellow citizens, along with hundreds of millions more in Iraq and the Middle East, know fully who you are and what you have done. You may evade justice, but in our eyes, you are each guilty of egregious war crimes, of plunder, and finally of murder, including the murder of thousands of young Americans, my fellow veterans, whose future you stole.
Your positions of authority, your millions of dollars of personal wealth, your public relations consultants, your privilege and your power cannot mask the hollowness of your character. You sent us to fight and die in Iraq after you, Mr. Cheney, dodged the draft in Vietnam, and you, Mr. Bush, went AWOL from your National Guard unit. Your cowardice and selfishness were established decades ago. You were not willing to risk yourselves for our nation, but you sent hundreds of thousands of young men and women to be sacrificed in a senseless war with no more thought than it took to put out the garbage.
I joined the Army 2 days after the 9/11 attacks. I joined the Army because our country had been attacked. I wanted to strike back at those who had killed some 3,000 of my fellow citizens. I did not join the Army to go to Iraq, a country that had no part in the September 2001 attacks and did not pose a threat to its neighbors, much less to the United States. I did not join the Army to liberate Iraqis or to shut down mythical weapons of mass destruction facilities or to implant what you cynically called democracy in Baghdad and the Middle East. I did not join the Army to rebuild Iraq, which at the time you told us could be paid for by Iraq's oil revenues. Instead, this war has cost the United States over $3 trillion. I especially did not join the Army to carry out preemptive war. Preemptive war is illegal under international law. And as a soldier in Iraq, I was, I now know, abetting your idiocy and your crimes. The Iraq War is the largest strategic blunder in U.S. history.
I would not be writing this letter if I had been wounded fighting in Afghanistan against those forces that carried out the attacks of 9/11. Had I been wounded there, I would still be miserable because of my physical deterioration and imminent death. But I would at least have the comfort of knowing that my injuries were a consequence of my own decision to defend the country I love. I would not have to lie in my bed, my body filled with painkillers, my life ebbing away, and deal with the fact that hundreds of thousands of human beings, including children, including myself, were sacrificed by you for little more than the greed of oil companies, for your alliance with the oil sheiks in Saudi Arabia, and your insane visions of empire.
I have, like many other disabled veterans, suffered from the inadequate and often inept care provided by the Veterans Administration. I have, like many other disabled veterans, come to realize that our mental and physical wounds are of no interest to you, perhaps of no interest to any politician. We were used, we were betrayed, and we have been abandoned. You, Mr. Bush, make much pretense of being a Christian. But isn't lying a sin? Isn't murder a sin? Aren't theft and selfish ambition sins? I am not a Christian, but I believe in the Christian ideal. I believe that what you do to the least of your brothers, you finally do to yourself, to your own soul.
My day of reckoning is upon me. Yours will come. I hope you will be put on trial. But mostly I hope for your sakes that you find the moral courage to face what you have done to me and to many, many others who deserve to live. I hope that before your time on earth ends, as mine is now ending, you will find the strength of character to stand before the American public and the world, and in particular the Iraqi people, and beg forgiveness. That was Thomas Young's letter, an open letter, to Bush and Cheney about the Iraq War.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
As computer technology has evolved and communications providers have profited, law enforcement and government intelligence organizations increasingly lobby to mandate that data services be engineered to allow them backdoor access to encrypted data. Even as expansive anti-terrorism legislation provides more way for the government to harvest our personal data, calls still continue for regulation of technology to ensure these extra access channels. With each high-profile criminal attack on U.S. soil or elsewhere across the world, government efforts to access personal communications have gained momentum. Years ago, many considered Tor, software that enables anonymous communication, to be equivalent to the dark net, the nefarious sites and services accessible on the Tor network that promote or enable illegal activity, such as drug and gun marketplaces. After Edward Snowden's massive data release, however, Tor use in the last year has grown very quickly. We are delighted to welcome Shari Steele, Executive Director of the Tor Project, to Law and Disorder. As the former director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Shari built it into the nation's preeminent digital rights organization. Shari Steele, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
When you were at the Electronic Frontier Foundation in 2004, you decided that it should fund Tor's early development. How did that come about, and why did you believe in Tor then?
That's actually kind of a funny story. I'm not a technologist, and so I didn't really recognize, certainly back in those early days, how important Tor was going to end up being. But there were some technologists who work for EFF who knew Roger, knew what they were doing, and understood Roger Dingledine, one of the founders of Tor, and knew that what was being done at the time Roger and Nick were graduate students or recent graduate students at MIT, that it was really, really important and that the project needed to survive. And back in those days, originally, Roger and Nick Mathewson, his partner, were funded a lot by the Navy, the Naval Research Labs, and the funding was drying up. And so they were thinking they were going to have to go out and get jobs and not be able to continue working on Tor. The technologists at EFF came to me and said, we really need to help them because this is important stuff that they're working on. And so we took Tor in. At first, we thought we would just help them with fundraising. And then we realized that we actually could afford to take them in for a year or two while they got on their feet. And so if you look in the archives, the original Tor access on the web was tor.eff.org.
And you've come full circle in a way.
I have. It's pretty funny.
Now, the Tor project, which develops and maintains the Tor network and software, launched in 2006. And since then, your team really has transformed what I think might have been an unwieldy technology for many people into a fully featured browser that's available on virtually every platform, such as Chrome and Firefox. What were the factors that helped in this revolution?
So the people who were developing Tor and the Tor browser were also users. I mean, it's that old eat your dog food adage where you really have to be able to say, I use this and it works, in order to be able to make sure that it works well. And so there was a really heavy emphasis, especially over the past couple of years, on usability, still trying to make it even more user-friendly. But that made the difference in the adoption rates of the tools.
Tell us a bit about the history of crypto wars in this country. And does the government's effort to unlock the Apple iPhone represent a new chapter?
Yes, it represents a new chapter, but it isn't anything particularly new. It's a new angle of, as you mentioned, these crypto wars that have been going on for years and years. I mean, there is this natural tension between law enforcement, who wants to be able to get access to everything really easily, and our rights and our civil liberties. And that tension has always existed and probably always will exist. The balance is, the key is finding the right balance balance and making sure that as new technologies develop, that we don't get out of balance. And in the crypto wars back in the 1990s, the government was trying to, at first, was trying to make it so that people couldn't use encryption widespread. And when I say people, I also mean companies, because companies were extremely interested in using encryption in order to be able to enable electronic commerce. That's what makes it so that you can do credit card transactions online. It is strong cryptography. And back in the 90s, that didn't really exist because they weren't able to use cryptography because it was listed as a munition. And then when it got freed up, the government tried to do what is called backdoors, tried to require manufacturers and ISPs and people who were providing service to allow them to be able to get access to plain text. At that time, we won the crypto wars. We, as in the people, won the crypto wars in that government, that companies and ISPs were told, you should help law enforcement as best as you can, but you don't need to build in back doors. So now this new iteration, which has come to a big head since the Apple iPhone stuff, is to try once again to get those back doors built in. So again, we're opposing that because it weakens all of our technology.
Really, I have an iPhone. One of the cases that you worked on at the Electronic Frontier Foundation was Bernstein versus the United States back in 1999, and that involved the exportation of cryptography outside of the U.S. Tell us a bit about that, please.
Right. So back in the early 90s, dating back to World War II, encryption was listed on the U.S. munitions list alongside flamethrowers and B-1 bombers, because it was only being used as a weapon. During World War II, one of the things that gave us a great advantage over Germany was our ability to decrypt the messages that they were sending back and forth. And so that was a closely guarded secret. But as technology developed and companies started to realize that in order to be able to do electronic transactions, they were going to need a strong way to protect the data that was going back and forth, it became clear that classifying encryption as a munition was really limiting their ability to do things. The problem was the companies, because it was a commercial interest versus a national security interest, couldn't bring a legal challenge. There wasn't any way, because courts would throw it out instantly and say this is national security. And so what they needed was a challenge that was not going to be a commercial interest. And EFF, of course, didn't have as much of an interest in the commercial stuff. We were much more interested in the rights stuff. And lo and behold, this mathematician named Dan Bernstein came to us and said, I've written this little encryption program. I just want to put it on this internet mailing list for colleagues of mine to look at it and take it apart. Just an intellectual investigation of how good it is. And I'm being told by the NSA that I'm not allowed to put it out on the internet because that's considered an export. And I would need a license to be an arms dealer in order to be able to put it out there. And I even tried to apply to be a license to be an to get a license to be an arms dealer, and they told me no, I couldn't have one because the encryption was too strong. So we came in and said, no, wait a minute, this is a First Amendment issue. We've got to get in there because this software that he has created is actually speech. It's a form of speech. And so we went into the courts. We were able to actually bring the legal challenge because only courts can decide First Amendment issues. You can't have that decided some other place. So it was First Amendment versus national security. And the courts held, you know what? This is speech. Source code is speech. And that was huge. It was not only huge for encryption, but it was huge for the whole, for everyone who works on programming to realize, you know what? We've always known that there's an expressive element to the thing that we're creating, and now it's actually protected by the First Amendment.
That's huge indeed, and it's really wonderful development. I wanted to read a short quote from Jacob Applebaum about Tor. He has said that it's, quote, part of an ecosystem of software that helps people regain and reclaim their autonomy. It helps to enable people to have agency of all kinds. It helps others to help each other. and it helps you to help yourself. It runs, it is open, and it is supported by a large community spread across all walks of life. Is Jacob still involved in the TOR project?
He is. Jake is an employee of the TOR project.
And what was his contribution to TOR?
Oh, he's been around since not the very earliest days, but early days. He is a big TOR evangelist. He says brilliant things like you just heard there. He does a lot of things of working with communities in various places, a lot of them unsafe places, and tries to get people to use TOR, teach them why it's important. He's been working lately. There's been some interesting art installations that have TOR involved with them. So he's an unconventional but really brilliant member of our community.
On your website, and I take this as part of an ongoing effort to, for lack of a better word, mainstream TOR, you have a wonderful section that says normal people use TOR with several examples. For example, explaining how using TOR protects users from their privacy from marketers and identity thieves, protects communications from corporations who may want to breach privacy, protects children online, as well as sensitive issues, for example, access to information on AIDS or birth control, avoids surveillance. And I wanted to mention that one of the people we interviewed was Allison Macrina of TOR's Library Freedom Project about the installation in the Lebanon, New Hampshire Library and the Department of Homeland Security visiting them. But the argument by many is that using TOR somehow enables illicit activity. And in fact, such activities on the so-called dark web are very few compared to the benefits of TOR. Is that an accurate statement?
It is. So there have been studies done related to TOR users versus the internet at large. It's a little bit harder to study the dark web, but the findings were that the percentage of people engaging in illicit activity is the same as on TOR by among TOR users as it is on the internet at large. So, yeah, it's unfortunate because the dark web is kind of sexy for journalists to pick up on. And so a lot of times there are stories that demonize TOR as being the way, the channel that's being used for criminal activity. But TOR is much, much more than that. And in fact, if you talk to any of the people who work on TOR, who are the developers for TOR, they're all freedom fighters. These are people who actually are doing it because they care passionately about making the world a better, safer place.
At EFF, your staff worked with developers building free and open source product aimed at protecting privacy. Tell us about the DES cracker.
The DES cracker. So DES, or DES, was an encryption program that the government put out and claimed was safe and secure and that people should use it, and particularly that banks should use it for financial transactions. And so it was the de facto standard for quite a bit of time. Cryptographers online questioned how strong an encryption it actually was. They believed that the government was encouraging the use of it because they believed the government could break it and would be able to get access to stuff if they wanted to. And so, led by John Gilmore, who is one of EFF's board members, a project got started to see if they could break DES, if they could, using just PCs, small computers, if they could build something that could crack DES. And the DES cracker was based on desktop computer technology that they modified. There were all sorts of chips that were used, but it was able to break DES. I think the first year it was able to break it in 3 days, and then the second, you might have the statistics in front of you because this is old. I'm pulling back stuff from the cobwebs of my brain here as to how quickly. But then the second year, they were able to crack it in a number of hours, which meant that the government, with its supercomputing power, was almost assuredly able to crack it. If just people using stuff off the streets were able to crack it. And so DES is no longer the de facto standard that's used for encryption.
We just have a few minutes remaining, Sherry, but I wanted to ask you, what threats, if any, does Tor face?
Well, the biggest threats, I guess, are, well, there's a couple. The biggest one is legislative. I mean, we're constantly seeing, and especially after the Apple, the recent Apple stuff in the news, we're seeing attempts at legislation through various different ways to require companies to backdoor their strong encrypted products. And so that would be a threat to Tor. It's not specifically Tor, but it's Tor. And then we're also seeing some threats from some company behaviors that are, I'm going to just say, disregarding Tor, to be kind. But Cloudflare right now is a big problem for Tor users. Cloudflare is security software that big companies can use to provide protection against distributed denial of services attacks. So if someone is trying to like take down their website, Cloudflare provides a front to stop them from doing that. And they use CAPTCHAs and various different ways to prove that you're a real person in order to be able to even get to the company's website. Mm. Well, the Cloudflare is breaking Tor a lot of times where Tor users can't get into those websites that they're trying to visit. So we're trying to work with them. But it's a frustrating thing where we've got a technology that is helping users be able to protect themselves and keep themselves safe and secure as they're doing their web browsing and as they're communicating online, and that there are things that are being developed that aren't thinking about the fact that it's there, and we kind of have to scramble to figure out how do we get this to work, even with these extra threats that are out there.
And before we ask about how people can learn more about Tor, can you just quickly summarize your long-term vision for the next few years for the organization?
Right. So Tor is really a critical part of the Internet Freedom Infrastructure. It actually is the Internet Freedom Infrastructure. It's what freedom fighters around the world use in order to be able to communicate with one another and to be able to get word out about what are the things that are happening in their countries, along with various other uses that we've already touched on a little bit during this interview. But Tor developed the technology without there really being any thought about the organization that supports the people who are working Tor. So there's no, I'll just say, infrastructure for the Tor organization. And so things like healthcare insurance or company vacation days or things that if you're thinking about it, you take care of the people who are working for you. Companies sort of do that. And so one of my key jobs is to help build that infrastructure so that the organization remains sustainable and that we don't have to worry about everybody burning out or feeling like they can't take a day off because there's no vacation policy, things like that. So that's one of the things. The other big thing is to try to make us financially sustainable. Right now, a lot of the money for the Tor project is coming from various different government grants and contracts because the State Department and various different other sections of the government understand how important Tor is for fighting for freedom around the world. But that's not really a sustainable model for the organization. And so we haven't done a whole lot of the more traditional nonprofit fundraising of going to foundations, going to individual donors. And so I'm trying to build up that whole part of the organization. And again, that includes infrastructure. We did this amazing end-of-year campaign last year where we brought in over $200,000, but really had no infrastructure. We didn't have a database. When people would come to our website, we'd send them to PayPal in order to make a donation because we didn't have a payment processor. So there are things that just that whole infrastructure needs to get built out in order for us to be able to get money from various different sources and really make the organization stronger and more sustainable.
Well, I think the next few years are going to be very exciting for TOR, and they're certainly in highly competent hands.
Thank you.
Can people find out more about you?
So we are online, of course. It's torproject.org. Invite you to come and take a look. We've got lots of information, very dense website with lots of information, so you can learn all about the TOR project and certainly support us as well.
Sherry Steele, thank you so much, and best of luck to you.
Good luck, Sherry. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
beautiful.